Okay, Dick, I just wanted to point out, I particularly like logarithms. I liked when I learned them. They're the basis for how slide rules work, and, well, mathematics is interesting to me, as tonight's puzzler will attest to. So unless anyone has any further comments, questions, statements, what have you, I'll just go into the science talk as usual, but I'll let it drop for a second and listen if anyone has anything to say.
And Roy likes people to participate, to participate. So if you have the slightest tendency, please participate. Over to the group.
Just a question. Dick, did you ever come across the antenna that was using clockwise and counterclockwise winding coils for extra low frequency energy?
I think you're asking me, have I ever used a clockwise or a counterclockwise helical antenna? The answer is yes. Back to you, Wes.
Can you remember the antenna that is clockwise and counterclockwise in one and is mostly made for low frequencies?
There is a kind of helical antenna which contains clockwise winding and counterclockwise winding in the middle of the same antenna. And so depending on which one of the input connectors you use, it will radiate clockwise or counterclockwise signal. And the interaction between those two, if you lay it out correctly, is fairly small. So it is possible to make a dual polarized antenna of a helical structure. There was another person who wanted to make a comment. Now, who was that other person? K2RIW.
B2 Bravo Zulu.
B2 GXM.
Bravo Zulu and GXM in that order. Mr. Bravo Zulu first, go ahead.
Dick and everybody else, my name's Rich. I don't know if it's not the time to ask a question about magnetic loops.
Well, because the big subject of discussion last week, or was it the week before? I think it was last week, was the so-called rolled loop monopole antenna. And we were comparing a multi-turn magnetic loop versus a single-turn magnetic loop. The answer is definitely yes. Let me come back to you, Rich, on that one. Let me first go to GXM first, and then we're going to come back to your magnetic loop. So we're going to stick with the subject on the floor for a little bit longer. That'd be B2GXM. Rich, go ahead with your question or comment.
WB2GXM. Concerning the subject of the helical, the helix wound, the spiral round antenna. There was an antenna back a few years called the Taxtenna, and I actually bought one, didn't put it together. I still have it in storage. I wondered if you've heard of it, and if you have heard of it, if you heard anything good about it. It's a helically wound antenna in reverse directions. WB2GXM.
And by the way, the helical antenna was invented by Mr. John Krause. WAJK, I think, was his call letters. He was the head of the electrical engineering department at Ohio University, if I understand correctly. And if you read his book called The Big Ear, he describes the slightly harrowing procedure he went through to invent and patent and develop, so to speak, the helical antenna. Now, this particular antenna that you're describing, I don't think I have actually ever run into that one. You might want to give us a couple of words on it. And did you buy one? Did you use it? And did it do what it was supposed to do? WB2GXM, K2LIW, wait for the beeps.
I believe it's the same kind of antenna Wes is describing, or I might be wrong. But I can't remember the designer's name. This is a full-length dipole that was wound into a helical design, and each side of the dipole was wound in the opposite direction. So a full 80-meter dipole can take up only three cubic feet, 3 feet by 3 feet, whatever. And a 40-meter dipole would be 2 feet by 2 feet. It was an interesting design. I never got around to doing it, so I was wondering if anyone heard about it.
AC2GS.
Roy recognized. The so-called rubber duck antenna is a kind of a helical antenna. And you have to recognize the fact that when you study John Krause's material in his book called Antennas, McGraw-Hill, 1950, that's the first edition, and there's two more editions after that. A helical antenna has two ways of operating. You can have the axial mode and the transverse mode. A helical antenna, a helical winding, when each turn is close to a wavelength in circumference, properly set up, tends to radiate primarily the axial mode. The signal goes right down the center of that helix. If each one of the turns is close to a wavelength in circumference. But in the case of a rubber duck, for instance, where each individual turn is an extremely small fraction of a wavelength, but there are multiple turns there, then the antenna radiates in the transverse mode, broadside. The rubber duck antenna on your handy talkie is a transverse mode helix. And so they're both helixes, very different in design, very different in performance, very different in gain, pattern, polarization characteristics, and so on. So they're both called helix. A helical winding of a dipole is a poor man, is a rich man's equivalent of putting a loading coil. You could have a lumped coil in the beginning of your dipole to bring it down to a much lower frequency, or you can spread that coil out, so to speak, along the whole length of the dipole, and as long as each individual turn is a small fraction of a wavelength in circumference, then it will be the transverse mode helix, which we call a helically wound antenna, and it's one of the many ways of physically compacting the antenna and yet keeping its electrical resonance at the desired characteristic. So I think this is what you're describing now, Rich. I know Roy wants to say something about this, and then I'm going to go back to Rich. AC2GS, K2LAW. Go ahead, Roy.
Yes, thanks, Dick. TAC-10, I wouldn't quite call it a helical antenna. It's more of a spiral. It's basically two setups with cross poles and a spiral going in the direction, it seems. Two versions of it. So there's a front version and there's a rear version. They appear to be simultaneously going in the same direction. So it's not that one's spiral clockwise and the other one's anti-clockwise, counterclockwise. So that's what I've been able to glean from their webpage. Spiral dipole type of configuration.
I think you said that you either bought or owned one or actually tested one. Wait for the beeps, Roy, which I didn't do, and tell us your acquaintance with this antenna and what you think of it. WB2GXM, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Well, I guess I should stop my particular angle on this. I never really got around to building it. Life got in the way. It was a very interesting idea, and it's still an interesting idea. I should dig that thing out. I'm glad that the website is still active. You can Google TAC-10 for anyone interested. It's an interesting design, and I do believe the designer of this antenna is one of those NASA rocket scientist types. It's got some credibility to it, WB2GXM.
I'm recognizing that TAC-10 and compact-10 are relatively close sounding. The rolled monopole is called compact-10, C-O-M-P-A-C-T-E-N-N-A, and TAC-10. Well, these antennas are really something else. Rich, Mr. Bravo Zulu, you want to talk about a magnetic loop, and every loop antenna is magnetic. So is there something magic about a particular loop that makes it more magnetic than another? It's an interesting question. A dipole antenna radiates a significant amount of magnetic field. It's got a strong magnetic field in the center of the dipole. So although people don't consider it that, a dipole is also a magnetic antenna. Mr. Bravo Zulu, K2RIW. Go ahead, Rich.
K2RIW and the NetW2BZ. In my long quest now to find an antenna that a one-story condo community, a long wire with a 9-to-1 balance, going to try that, into a screwdriver antenna, as you might remember. In fact, I have the wire ready to wind around the 2-inch toroid L200 coil for the 9-to-1 unun. And the other one that is the magnetic loop. Now, it's my understanding that the magnetic loop, well, let me put it a different way. How does the magnetic loop get away with two things? You don't have to have it very high, as high as a dipole, and there are no ground radios, no ground system whatsoever. It seems to defy the law of other physics and other antennas. So that's my question. How does a magnetic loop do that?
Okay. Now, when you say it doesn't have any ground plane radios, doesn't have any counterpoise and so on, the way a so-called magnetic loop antenna, conventionally constructed by ham radio operators and maybe even scientists, the way it's conventionally made is that you have a main loop, which is a fraction of a wavelength in circumference, with a great big loading capacitor at the open gap at one side. You know, it's a real circular object, and the circle is not completely closed. There's a slight gap at the there's a gap at 12 o'clock on this circular object, and you've got a capacitor there, which brings it into resonance, and you feed energy into it by making a much smaller loop, which you usually put at the 6 o'clock position, and the smaller loop is fed by a piece of coaxial cable. The smaller loop has the center conductor going to this little bit of a loop, which comes around and comes back to the shield of the coax cable. And the plane of a smaller loop and the plane of the larger loop are coplanar, and one is an impedance match to the other. So there really is a real center conductor and shield to the transmission line. It's feeding that smaller loop. The smaller loop is kind of the primary of the transformer, so to speak, and the secondary is the big loop, which is now the resonator. The big loop, with its resonance, is the one that develops the very strong magnetic field that does 95% of the radiating. So the big loop does the radiating. It is the resonance structure. The small loop is just finding a way of feeding energy into the larger loop. That's the usual method of construction. And so I'm not going to discuss altitude characteristics yet, but when it comes to, does it have a counterpoise? Is it does it need a grounding? It doesn't need grounding. You could say the grounding is the shield of the transmission line, so to speak, that's feeding the small loop, that's in turn exciting the larger loop. So let's discuss that much so far first, Rich. W2BZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Let me interrupt for a moment. Could you have a four-year counterpoise? When you have a vector of force, you have the opposite vector of force. I have a problem with your statement, Dick, standing that the ground is not needed. There is a capacitive coupling. Enter again.
Okay, let me turn it back to Mr. BZ first. Mr. BZ, go right ahead.
Wes brought it up to what you said. Now I am about a counterpoise. Does it need radios? Does it need a... and why? I've seen the inner loop at the 12 o'clock position, not at the 6 o'clock position, on instructions that I've seen, but I may be recalling it incorrectly. You're saying the field of the coax. Is that correct?
When it comes back to you, Rich, try speaking a little bit softer because you are dropping out 50% of the time, and I think the dropout might be because the repeater thinks you're overmodulating. That's a guess, but you are dropping out a lot. Now, I made it sound like I was saying that the shield of the coax is the counterpoise. I should not have said that. Okay. In order to radiate a signal, you've got to do about three things. One, you're creating a pretty strong resonant magnetic field. By a resonating structure, 98% of the time, you're creating a pretty strong magnetic field. Whether it be a loop or a dipole, you're creating a pretty strong magnetic field, and that begins the radiating process. So creating the strong magnetic field by way of resonance is one of the characteristics in general for an antenna. Another characteristic is that you want the transmission line to feed signal into that resonating structure. The transmission line in the small loop does that. An awful lot of people believe that every antenna requires a ground to work correctly. That one, I think, is not true most of the time. An astronaut floating in space behind the International Space Station with a dipole in his hand, so to speak, and a transmitter feeding that dipole, he's 260 miles above the Earth. There is no ground anywhere near him. That antenna radiates extremely well without a ground. And there are some people who will say that, the body of the human being is trying to act like a ground. But that could be an 80-meter dipole, and the human being's body is such a small fraction of a wavelength that there's no ground there at all. I mean, you can put the transmitter in the middle of the dipole, suspend it 260 miles in space, because the astronaut is holding onto this thing, floating behind the International Space Station in free space. No ground at all. No real Earth ground anywhere. And it radiates like a charm. Let me drop this. The only time when you have an extremely strong need for a ground is that if you have an antenna that is unbalanced. The ideal antenna has got two connectors going into it. If you're feeding it with open wire line, one could be called the current in, and the other one is the current coming back out, so to speak. And so there are kinds of antennas where you take the end of the open wire line, and one of those connectors of the open wire line, the transmission line, connects to the end of this long wire antenna, and the other end connects to nothing. And the other lead of the open wire transmission line goes to nothing. An in-fed ZEP could be fed that way. The only reason you can get away with that, and that one seems to have no real counterpoise, no complete circuit to it, so to speak. The only way you can get away with that is that if the wire itself is a near resonant length, like half wave, and you're feeding the open end of it, where the single end that you're feeding has an impedance of quite a few thousand ohms, and therefore you can get away with a very shaky ground, so to speak, and you're still feeding signal into it. If the impedance of that antenna, because it's a quarter wavelength long, is 30 ohms, and you feed it with open wire line and only use one line of the open wire line, 5% of the energy will go into the antenna, and the other 95% will be reflected on the open wire line. You'll think you've got an extremely high standing wave ratio antenna. So the exact impedance of your piece of wire, and whether or not you're feeding it as a two-wire system or a one-wire system, in some cases you can get away with it. That's some of the story that I think you're looking for, Rich. I know that it's not the whole story. W2BZ, K2LIW in the TechNet, wait for the beeps.
And is there also, I hope this is better, sometimes I get excited and I forget that I have to be a couple of inches away from the mic. Is the requirement, let me put it this way. Is a magnetic loop with somebody who's so restricted in both length and height, probably as close to the ideal apartment dwelling antenna as one can get.
On that transmission, Rich, you did a beautiful job of backing away from the mic just the right amount. You're giving us full volume audio and no dropouts. You've got it just right on that transmission. The two previous transmissions, you were dropping out 50% of the time. So you've done good. Now, a magnetic loop, if you want it to be omnidirectional, you're going to make the circumference a small fraction of a wavelength, 1/16, something like that, 1/32 of a wavelength, circumference. As you make it closer and closer to a half wavelength in circumference, it starts developing a specific azimuthal antenna pattern. It's not going to be omnidirectional. So the average person who sets up a magnetic loop usually wants it to be omnidirectional. Therefore, he makes it small in circumference, which really is small in diameter, and he's got a fairly substantial capacitor at the open end, which brings it into resonance. And I've usually seen the capacitor at the 12 o'clock position and the input feeding loop, small loop, at the 6 o'clock position. There's nothing magic about the 6 o'clock position. You could feed it at 9 o'clock, 3 o'clock, and so on. You could feed it at 12 o'clock. I didn't say, you may have to change the diameter of the loop and the closeness and the orientation to adjust the impedance match. You're adjusting the spacing between the small loop and the large loop, and the diameter of the small loop, and the spacing of the small loop, and the tuning of the large loop. You juggle those three factors, you'll eventually come to a point of both resonance and a good impedance match. I think that's some of the information you're looking for, Rich. W2BZ, wait until you really hear the beeps. K2RIW.
Capacitors on the smaller loop also. Is that correct? And also on the larger loop, I've seen, what are they called, vacuum capacitors, you know, really high impedance capacitors. I guess things get quite hot up there, huh?
There are loop antenna designs where the small loop also has a tuning capacitor. It's not necessarily required. If you're willing to juggle the diameter and spacing of the small loop, as well as the tuning of the large loop, if you're willing to juggle those three things correctly, you don't always need a variable capacitor in the small loop. However, that does give you one more variable to work with if there is a variable capacitor on the small loop. It's not always required. Now, I'm trying to remember what's the other thing you're asking now. Efficiency, when it comes to the vacuum variable capacitor, it's frequently used. Because the Q of the structure is very high, a so-called magnetic loop where you've intentionally set it up to be very omnidirectional, which means you've made the circumference, let me pick a number, 1/16 of a wavelength. You therefore might have a Q of 100. A Q of 100. By the way, one of the many definitions of Q, let me drop. The usual definition of Q is center frequency divided by bandwidth. Another definition is energy stored versus energy dissipated, rise time and fall time. But a huge definition that's also used of Q is voltage rise at resonance and current rise at resonance. If your transmission line is a 50-ohm line and you're putting 50 watts into it, that means the transmission line, if it's being properly impedance matched, has 50 volts at 1 ampere. Your transmitter is putting 1 ampere at 50 volts into that transmission line because you're launching a 50-watt signal into a 50-ohm transmission line. 50 volts, 1 ampere. If you put it into a magnetic loop that has a Q of 100, which is a number that you might approach, you multiply the voltage by 100. 100 times 50 volts is 5,000 volts. So the capacitor will see something close to 5,000 volts with that Q of 100 magnetic loop antenna. You're launching 1 ampere into the transmission line. That means that somewhere in that loop, will probably 100 amperes is flowing, because it's got a Q of 100. So voltage rise at resonance and current rise at resonance is two of the other definitions of Q. So because it's going to be, 100 times 50 is 5,000. There's going to be 5,000 amperes, the RF frequency, flowing through that capacitor. You've got to be kind of careful about that capacitor. You might want to use a vacuum variable, which can tolerate high voltage without dissipating energy. Or you want to make sure it's an air variable capacitor. If you think you're going to use any compact capacitor, like a disc ceramic, which doesn't have anywhere near as low an insertion loss as a vacuum variable, you're probably going to burn it up with dissipation. So unless you very carefully choose that tuning capacitor in that loop, it could be dissipating quite a bit of heat, and it could be burning up when you're running the system at the 100-watt level. And if you want to take a magnetic loop and run it at a kilowatt, that is an extremely difficult requirement. I didn't say it's impossible, but boy, you got to be careful. I think you're seeing some of the reason why, Rich. W2 Bravo Zulu, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Absolutely. I guess the only reason to feel lucky I only have 100 watts barefoot is in a magnetic loop. Okay, I got that part of it. Last two questions. A, what are you tuned for? What meter, what are you looking at when you're tuning that capacitor on the magnetic loop? Is it simply just, is it going into an antenna tuner and then you're just tuning, you still have to be tuning the capacitor somehow. That's number one. For something, not somehow. You have to be tuning the capacitor for something. How do you find that something? And number two, and this brings up what Wes came in and said, what about counterpoise?
Richard, this is the best of all worlds. Your antenna represents a pure 50-ohm resistor. When you adjust all of the variables in your bag of tricks, the variable capacitor, maybe the dimensions of the large loop, certainly the dimension of the small loop, and the positioning, the closeness of the small loop. When you adjust all of those parameters correctly, you can force the antenna to be a 50-ohm resistor at the input end of the transmission line, in which case it'll have no reflected energy. So one of the best ways to tune the thing is for the lowest possible standing wave ratio. The easiest way to do that would be to set up a bird watt meter directly between your transmitter and the antenna, and set the bird watt meter to look once in a while, just for the heck of it, you look at forward power and make sure your transmitter is putting out 10 watts during the time you're doing this alignment procedure. But you're going to run the bird watt meter most of the time in the reverse mode. You're going to look at reflected power. You're going to be adjusting all of the variables in your bag of tricks until the reflected power goes to zero. When you can set it up so that during the time you're tuning it, 10 watts is going forward and nearly 0 watts is coming back, you have hit the right tuning. And there's a lot of interaction between those tuning knobs. As you adjust the variable capacitor, as you adjust the diameter of the small loop, the orientation of the small loop, and the position, the closeness of the small loop, in other words, you can change the plane of the small loop. That's one of the variables, by the way. As you adjust all the variables you've got, you will see the reflective power going up and down, and you're tuning for the biggest dip, but the transmitter is still putting out power. And by the way, because during some of this tuning procedure, let me drop this. Because during some of this tuning procedure, your antenna might represent a fairly high standing wave ratio before you hit the right ballpark. Your transmitter might be unhappy with that higher standing wave ratio, in which case it would be real nice to have an attenuator, like at least a 3 dB attenuator, between the transmitter and this tuning procedure. That limits the amount of standing wave ratio the transmitter will see. It'll keep the transmitter happy and keep its power output more constant. So you're either adjusting the transmitter for a very low power output and or it's going through an attenuator, and you're using your bird watt meter or any other kind of standing wave ratio device to look at minimum reflective power or minimum standing wave ratio. So you're adjusting all the variables for minimum reflective power. When you can make that reflective power look like it's gone to essentially zero, you hit the ballpark. You hit the center. You hit home plate. Let's discuss that much first. W2 Bravo Zulu, K2LAW. Does that make some sense, Rich? Go ahead.
Makes perfect sense. So you are watching a bird watt meter while you're tuning one or both of the capacitors on that magnetic loop, and you're just tuning it as we always tune it, you know, for the lowest possible SWR. Is that what you're saying? And I guess with very little power going into the antenna during tuning, there's no danger of touching, you know, by touching the variable capacitors, there's no danger there, because I see them, I've seen a lot of construction of these type of loops, and they seem, they just hang the capacitors, you know, where they're soldered to the loops. There's no, some of them, of course, have enclosures, but a lot of them are just hanging there. So is there any danger in tuning them? And do you tune the small one first if you have a small tuning capacitor, and then the big one, or it doesn't matter?
There's no easy way of saying which one you tune first, second, and third, so to speak. And as I said before, many of these designs have no capacitor on the small loop. It isn't mandatory. You can find a solution with the small loop having no capacitor. It's just going from center conductor to shield of the transmission line. But you're changing its position, meaning closeness to the large loop, and orientation. You might be changing the plane of it. And while you're with a wooden stick, you're pushing the small loop closer or further away from the large loop, using a wooden stick so that your finger is not affecting the capacitance of your finger, and the moisture in your body is not affecting the tuning. With another remote tuning device, you're changing the capacitor on the big loop. So you're changing capacitance of big loop, position and orientation of small loop, and maybe eventually diameter of small loop. So and which order you do, you tune each one of them until you hit a null with that adjustment. Then you go to the other adjustment and see if you can get a better null. And there's interruption. When you adjust, you might adjust the big loop for a half of a null, the big loop capacitor for a half loop of null. Then you adjust the position of a small loop, and you get the half null go to a quarter null. And then because there's interaction, you go back and recheck the big loop tuning capacitor and so on. So there's interaction with these things. Which one you do first, second, and third doesn't matter, as long as you adjust each one of them to the best null you can get for that one at that time before you go to the other one. By the time you've finished doing all of this juggling, and you may discover that you've done the best juggling of position, orientation, of small loop, and big capacitor on the big loop, and you can't get any better than a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, then maybe it's time to start doing something else, increasing the diameter or decreasing the diameter of the small loop and starting all over again. When you do it right, when you hit the right combination of all the three or four variables, you will get a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio. Don't give up. Every loop antenna has a tuning procedure that will get you to a 1-to-1. Wait until you hear all three beeps. Over to you, Bravo Zulu, K2RIW.
Okay. I understand everything you're saying. And in light of that, Dick, would you say, again, I am restricted in terms of putting out radials. I'm restricted in height. I mean, I could stick this thing 15 feet up in the air while I'm operating, and then I would have to take it down. I don't even know if it needs 15 feet up in the air, and does height matter that much? And then the last open piece of the puzzle for me is, first of all, is it very narrow bandwidth? That's number one. And I think I can get away with making a quarter wave loop. I think I can do that. Is it very narrow bandwidth at a quarter wave loop? And again, that counterpoise question.
Most of the reasonable diameters that people set up a so-called magnetic loop, they tend to be high in Q. That's a fancy way of saying rather narrow band. If you built it for 40 meters and you'd like to cover 7.0 to 7.3, I don't think it's going to make it. It's certainly not going to make it across all of 80 meters, for instance. So as you make it larger in circumference, you get good and bad. The good is it becomes more broadband. Never becomes super broadband, never as broad as a dipole. It's always a little bit more narrow than a dipole. But it now is developing a directional characteristic. There's another variable here we haven't discussed, and that is once you adjust for the right amount of tuning, and the tuning for, if you keep the antenna that you're building more than, let me pick a number, a half wavelength above the ground, well, on VHF frequencies, that's easy. On HFs, it's hard. On HF frequencies, keep it more than 5 feet above the ground. On VHF frequencies, keep it more than a half wavelength above the ground. Once you do that, the distance above ground and the tuning has a rather minor interaction. So you're tuning it, and if you change the height, it's not going to make a huge difference in the standing wave ratio. Now, once it's tuned, are you going to set up the loop parallel to the Earth's magnetic, parallel to the ground, or perpendicular? Set the loop perpendicular, and you radiate primarily vertical polarization. And now you have the ability to bring it very close to the Earth if you want to. If you set it up for horizontal polarization, which means the plane of the loop is parallel to the ground, now, true of all horizontally polarized antennas, they tend to make a null on the horizon. Therefore, you want as much altitude as possible in order to make the vertical antenna pattern give you the lowest possible lobe for the best possible DX. You're not forced into doing that when you set it up perpendicular. When the plane of the loop is perpendicular to the Earth, it radiates vertical polarization. And now you can bring it very close to the ground without any huge disadvantage if you desire it. There's another variable you've got with this antenna. Over to you, Rich. Wait for the beeps. K2RIW.
I have some comments on the subject, Dick. Into EO.
Please stand by, Rich. Go ahead, into EO. Mr. DZ first, go ahead.
So, yes, I've seen pictures of these loops. I saw a picture of a full wave on 80 loop on the ground, and I've seen others on the ground. When I was in college, way back in the Vietnam days, I had a 6-meter halo antenna. Was that a magnetic loop?
Absolutely. Nobody calls it that, but the hula hoop antenna, the 6-meter halo, was definitely a magnetic loop antenna. And I'm not sure, one of those brand names, maybe it was Cushcraft, but I'm not sure there was a variable capacitor on a small loop, but there certainly was a fixed capacitor, substantial fixed capacitor, on the large loop. Don't remember whether or not it was tunable. But yes, you can locate these things very close to the ground when they are vertically polarized. You can set it up very close to the ground, horizontally polarized, if you want to. You can still end up with a pretty good standing wave ratio, but the elevation antenna pattern is not going to give you very much DX, if you know what I mean. It's going to be closer to a near vertical incident sky wave antenna. So, by the way, when it comes to magnetic loops for 80 meters, Mel, K2KEY, he ran one of those for quite a number of years. An 80-meter, I think it was a full wavelength circumference loop antenna in his backyard, which was roughly 40 feet above the ground. and he had some rather good performance out of that. Because it was a full wavelength in circumference, it wasn't a conventional design magnetic loop, but it still was. He got good performance out of it. Because he couldn't rotate it, he couldn't measure its antenna pattern. I guarantee it didn't have a omnidirectional pattern out to the horizon, if you know what I mean. It probably radiated more to the north than to the east. I know that Rich EO wants to tell us something now about his loop experience. N2EO, K2RIW. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, fine, Dick, and thank you for letting me come in. I've been investigating a loop because I'm going to be downsizing. This house is being sold, and I have a buyer, and I'm going to go into a place that may not have the room for a dipole. But MFJ makes two versions of a loop antenna. They get one for 10, 15, and 20. That's one version they make. The other model covers 15 to 40. They're not big. And the nice thing about them, Dick, is it comes with a whole tuning unit that sits in your shack. It reads SWR. It's got a stepper motor in the antenna. It'll step it from frequency to frequency, and you read the SWR to get it down to minimum. Let me reset. Also, there was another loop that used to be on the market. It required a control cable between the loop and the box. On the MFJ, they couple the DC into the coaxial cable. And you know that works. I'm sure you're familiar with it. So you don't need a separate cable. Just coax from the antenna to the control box and from the control box to your radio. My attitude, Dick, these days is I'll build it, but only if I can't buy it. And this looks a very nice product.
Dick, is there any calculation for the size of the capacitor?
I could almost say no. You're going to have to find that experimentally. The nice thing about loop antennas is they tend to be physically compact. If, for instance, you are forced to operate from a trailer, one of these very compact homes, and you want to operate on 80 or 40 meters, with rare exception, you're not going to have the real estate to set up a 132-foot dipole in 80 meters or a 67-foot dipole in 40 meters, whereas a so-called magnetic loop antenna can fit into some number of square feet. And properly designed, they are physically compact. They're narrowband. You're going to have to do some tuning. Every time you QSY, you're going to have to do some tuning if you don't want to live with a pretty high standing wave ratio. But that's a good trade-off. Even though it's narrowband, as long as you're willing to do some tuning every time you QSY, the antenna gives you darn good performance. I think you can get 90% efficiency out of a compact loop on these HF frequencies with something that only occupies a few square feet, nowhere near these 130 and 67 foot dimensions that would a full length dipole would require. So the loop antenna has the advantage of saving you space, and there's various ways of remotely tuning it. Tuning is going to be required. And as long as you don't want to go there to the antenna itself to do the tuning, and in most cases you don't, because it's at the other end of the transmission line. So there's going to be some kind of remote tuning for many installations. And so there's ways of doing it with a multi-conductor cable, and if you're real smart, there's ways of doing the tuning with putting voltage up the center conductor of the transmission line itself. So there's pluses and minuses on the degree of complexity of the remote tuning, but there is going to be required remote tuning, in my opinion. I wonder if you've... I don't think you have to worry about remote tuning yet in your particular environment, GZB, GXM. I don't think you need that. You want to make the antenna work first, and later on you'll find out how you're going to be the tuning. Unfortunately, there's no easy way of predicting how big that capacitor's got to be. And so you're going to have to find that experimentally. There's a way of calculating. Let me drop this. Once you know the diameter, which is really the circumference, of the main loop, you can estimate its amount of inductance in microhenries or nanohenries, and you're going to resonate it. So therefore, in theory, you can calculate the size of that capacitor. It's going to give you a 50% error when you do it that way, but at least that's got you in the ballpark. You're not going to be 10-to-1 wrong in capacitance. You might be 2-to-1 wrong in capacitance. And tuning it is like a blind man walking up a hill. A blind man knows which way is up the hill because he can feel the tilt with his feet. In your case, if the capacitor you start off with is too big or too small, as you tune for the best null, you'll find out that you're running out of capacitance on the high side or the low side. You'll know which direction you've got. So you can estimate it, but it's still going to require some tuning, some tweaking, as you can tell. You're not going to be able to get this one right on the head, in my opinion. WB2GXM, K2RIW. Go ahead, Rich.
Sorry, Dick, you got your Rich's confused. That's W2BZ.
W2BZ. What about tuning it... Antenna analyzer.
The antenna analyzer is also a kind of standing wave ratio indicator. So any kind of standing wave ratio indicator, antenna analyzer, or bird watt meter, as long as you can set the meter to measure either visual or reverse power, in other words, reflective power. If you can measure reflective power and know it, or if you can measure visual and minimize it, I think your antenna analyzer allows you to do that. Am I correct on that one? To be 2BZ, K2IW. Sorry, I got you mixed up. You got a BZ.
Yes, it is able to do that. And I want to really hawk this antenna analyzer that I bought for guys who don't have much money to buy these things. I just bought the circuit board of a Rig Experts AA30, and it's called an AA30.0, and I've been very happy with it. Not that I understand it completely, and I bother Roy a lot about helping me understand it, but I just found out that you can get a Bluetooth little connector for $5 for it, and then use it with an Android phone. Remotely, without having to be, at the rig or at the antenna line inside, you could be outside at the antenna with the Bluetooth. So $77 for a full-fledged, not the best, the low end, but a full-fledged antenna analyzer. Let me let it drop a second. Now, Dick, you said that you misspoke when you said the counterpoise is the shield on the transmission line. And then Wes came in and had a comment, and you said you'd get back to Wes, but first of all, could you clear up the counterpoise issue with this antenna?
Partially. I'm going to give it a try. If I was setting up a quarter wave vertical ground plane antenna, it is a quarter wavelength radiator, a tiny bit shorter than that, maybe 95% of that, but physically it's a quarter wave long. It has a base fed impedance, usually of around 35 ohms, because it's half of a dipole. And as I've told you guys before, a dipole is really a pair of ground plane antennas back to back. You can set up a half wave dipole and put a large sheet of conductor, infinite sheet of conductor, right in the middle of the dipole, at right angles to the dipole. A hole in that sheet where the dipole goes through, but that infinite sheet of metal is at the null point of the dipole. You've got voltage at one instant of time. You've got positive voltage on the right side of the dipole and negative voltage on the left side, and the sheet of metal I'm describing is at the null plane. No current flows in that. And so putting the sheet of metal there does not change the pattern. The Vizsla changes nothing. But once you can put that sheet of metal there, you realize that you could, if you want to, feed the right-hand side of the dipole against the sheet of metal and throw away the left-hand side of the dipole. You're now simulating the left-hand side of the dipole by way of the mirror image in the sheet of metal. However, that sheet of metal now is going to have a significant amount of current flowing through it. You now want that sheet of metal to be very large in the ideal world. You can get away with making it a quarter wavelength, a bunch of quarter wavelength radials. That's the skeleton version of it. But now that's a clear need for a counterpoise, because of all the current you launch into that radiator, you're launching the exact same amount of current of opposite polarity into the ground plane structure. That's a real counterpoise. Half your current is going into each, and it's balanced, so to speak, when it's mounted above the ground. Let me drop the point. By comparison now, the current that flows in this loop antenna that you and I are now describing, you could say that current is flowing between the main tuning capacitor and the inductance of the large loop. You could say that the energy is bouncing back and forth. At one instant of time, when the voltage is maximum on the capacitor, all of the stored energy at that instant, 1/2 CV² in joules, is in the capacitor. And the current is going through, the current in the loop is going through zero at that instant. A quarter a wavelength later, as the voltage on the capacitor is swinging from positive maximum to negative maximum, as it goes through zero, the current in the big loop is at maximum at that instant. So at that instant, all the stored energy is in the main loop magnetic field, and because the voltage on the capacitor is swinging through zero, there is zero stored energy in the capacitor. So I've now described to you what happens for each quarter wave of the sine wave that this thing is radiating. Energy is bouncing back and forth between the capacitor and the rest of the inductor, the loop itself. That current between the two creates the cyclic magnetic field that allows you to transmit that signal. You'll notice that no current is flowing into Earth during that procedure. No current is flowing into Earth. So therefore, it doesn't seem to need a counterpoise. Does that seem to make some sense to you so far? W2 Bravo Zulu, K2RIW. Magnetic field at resonance is created in that structure, and it doesn't seem to need current flowing into a ground plane, a counterpoise. Does that seem to make some sense? W2 Bravo Zulu, K2RIW.
It does seem to make some sense. However, it does. Is it, well, let me ask you this. How does it differ from a dipole? Well, you just described it with the sheet of metal, that a dipole doesn't need a counterpoise either.
You got it. That dipole would work beautifully in the hands of an astronaut while he's floating in space behind the International Space Station. He's 260 miles above Earth. That'll radiate like a charm with that beautiful donut pattern, if you know what I mean. Bravo Zulu, RIW.
Well, I think I have it, and the way to physically construct it, I think a half-inch PVC, I read, is as bendable as you need to make the circle for the big loop, and then it's easy with copper tubing or whatever to make the inner loop. The only thing is, you know, it won't be motorized tuning, but to see how... CW out on the air finally. I think this is the way to go. I could put it about 5 feet off the ground very easily and bring my antenna analyzer out there and tune the capacitor as such. Do you think a quarter wave loop would need a vacuum tube variable capacitor, Vic?
Yeah, you've got a very good point there. As you make the loop larger in circumference, you develop an antenna pattern. It's not omnidirectional in azimuth anymore when it's parallel to the ground. That's a minor disadvantage, but the amount of voltage in the capacitor gets smaller and smaller, and now you don't have to use a vacuum variable. I don't think you're going to use a vacuum variable. The hula hoop on 6 meters had no vacuum variable, and it worked like a charm. It had very high efficiency, if you know what I mean. It ran ice cold even if you put 100 watts into it. If you have any doubt, well, if you're making the capacitor as an air variable capacitor, by definition, it is high in efficiency. There's no real dielectric there except air, and air is very low in loss, if you know what I mean. You start adding disc ceramic capacitors and glass and other things like that, you've got to worry about dissipation. So larger in diameter makes the capacitor smaller, easier to build, not exotic, greater in bandwidth. It's still going to be a little bit narrow band, but greater in bandwidth. That's a good way to go, and once you start doing that tuning with your antenna analyzer, I think you're going to see some good things. Don't give up on getting a one-to-one standing wave ratio. When you finally use all of your variables to the extent that's needed, you will hit one-to-one Viswell, Rich. W2BZ, K2RIW.
WB2GXM.
There was somebody else in there real quick. I just want to, can that variable capacitor be on the bottom of the loop for reachability, Dick?
Absolutely. GXM, go right ahead.
W2BZ, WB2GXM. Rich, I should point out that if you want this antenna to be efficient, you need to make that large loop as lossless as possible. That's why they use copper tubing for refrigerators and they use heavy-duty solder. You can't get away with a half-ass soldering here. You have to have a very low-loss loop. You might want to consider a commercially made loop antenna as opposed to trying to build it yourself. By the way, that's what you have to look out for, WB2GXM.
Bravo Zulu, go ahead.
Copper tubing is preferred, and now I know why it's preferred. So, yeah, I will take a look at that. I think these loop antennas are overpriced from what I've seen for what's in them, but I will do my best. Is there, for the size of capacitor that I would need, without it being a vacuum capacitor, Dick, what is there an economical source of capacitors of this size? I know at the Hamfest there was a whole table of capacitors, and I'm kicking myself, but is there one source or a source for these?
That I don't know. And you were also We haven't discussed yet whether or not the capacitor is made out of two plates that are flat and close to each other, parallel to each other, or is it a multi-plate device. You can make two large plates, two plates close to each other, with a dielectric screw between the two that changes the spacing, and that's one way of getting very high Q capacitor, and it's variable. By adjusting the screw, you change the spacing, which changes the capacitance. That's one approach, and the other approach is real meshing multiple plates. Try not to use the meshable multiple plates at first. Try to do it with two plates close to each other with a dielectric screw between the two. Let's see if... here I don't know what commercial products... And by the way, the commercial products have got a high price.